I still have forgotten where we were again.
We had, the last time, had been talking about managerial aspects of the home stake, mine and you were telling me something of the way boards and directors work. Fascinating, and I wondered whether you would be interested in talking a little bit about the same general area with respect to the Cerro de Pasco, which I think of as being perhaps the other most continuing interest in your career.
Yes, though Cerro was a close interest of mine for quite a while, though it's been a great many years now since I was on that board. The Cerro de Pasco Corporation was not controlled at the beginning by as close a group as Homestake was, and the participation of the Hearsts was after Senator Hearst's death, and it was the Hearst estate that went into it as one of the rather simply one of a quite a much larger syndicate, so their participation was not as big as it was in Homestake. And Edward Clark, who was the manager of the Hearst estate, that was Phoebe Hearst's estate, was on the board of Cerro de Pasco as their representative, and then in the various developments of the enterprise, when a corporation was set up and the original syndicate disappeared, he continued as, I think, a vice president, and eventually became president of Cerro de Pasco, as well as president of Homestake.
Was this simultaneous? Was he president?
Yes, he was.
Incredible.
But he was really acting rather as a business manager rather than as an active, very dynamic, rather than a technical manager. He always placed great authority and trust in the people who were actually running the enterprise, such as the general manager in Peru, who was really a very active, dominant person, and the what they called the superintendent then at Homestake.
Oh, yes.
They had much more independent power than they had later. So then the Cerro de Pasco Company became a public company, and it went through not reorganizations, but it evolved into a big company in which the original syndicate owners rather faded into the background. Some stayed on as members of the board, and some disappeared. And in the present Cerro de Pasco Company, I would doubt if anybody is on the board who has any relation to the old syndicate now.
Who comprised the syndicate that began?
Well, the Hearst's estate, not and the Hagen Group, and the Vanderbilts were in it, and a number of others. I'm not quite sure.
I was just interested in the spread.
That was rather before my time.
Were there Peruvian interests?
No.
This was entirely
American. That is the idea of trying to finance these, trying to bring in the nationals in these enterprises was never thought of in those days. And the great trouble is there isn't the money in those countries. There wasn't then and there isn't now. But today they are so intensely nationalistic that in most new enterprises, an effort, if you're there at all, if you have the nerve to be there at all, an effort is made to have participation by the people of the country in some way. But it usually means a free ride. It's not often that any private or public organization in those countries pays its share of the early expenses.
I see, and the, let's say the originators of the syndicate do pay their share.
Oh yes, they would put up their money and they would pay their share, and then of course when it was put on the, a company was made public and put on the market, they would undoubtedly retain a big chunk of that stock for what they had contributed in the beginning. And it would depend a great deal on what they had found as to how much they had to give away to get the public participation.
And is that governed by legal structure or just by the market?
Oh, no, that would be, it would be both. For example, suppose a syndicate got together and put up, perhaps $1 million to do a piece of exploration. And they found something that was, marginal, not very good, not very bad. In order to get the next few millions they'd need, they probably would have to give a very large participation of anybody who'd be willing to risk his money then. But then on the other hand, suppose in that initial work, they really hit something extraordinarily good, then they needed more money. If they weren't willing to put it up themselves, then they could get it for a very small participation. Well, then they would have something to sell.
Yes, I see.
But that's, of course, there are lots of legal ramifications of what you can do and what you can't do. But the basic thing is to find something very good. And of course, it would be quite illegal to, it would be a fraud to have something that was very poor and then not reveal all the facts about it. But on the other hand, you might have spent $1 million on an ore deposit and it was just, it was something you didn't want to throw away, but it was something you didn't want to spend any more money on it. And it's a great risk to spend more money, and if you make all the facts available, somebody might be willing to take that risk for quarter interest, a half interest, or 90% interest.
Does this sort of marginal situation occur very often?
Oh, yes. Well, the Homestake Company has been in exploration in Peru for the last few years as a managing partner of, in a sense, a syndicate with some other very much more powerful organizations, some oil companies, who have a lot of money to put into exploration. And in the course of that, we have been able to get hold of a couple of mining properties in Peru that have a good deal of potential and that might be what we call porphyry coppers, that is, a very, very big, low-grade operation. But the drilling is only partially done, and the ore is of such marginal grade that it would have to be extremely big to be worth anything, and it's a very costly thing to go on exploring. And so we were more or less at a stage where one of the partners was becoming reluctant to go ahead. And we certainly are not going to put our own money into it beyond a certain limit. And I think it would be almost impossible today to get anybody to put the money into that in Peru. In fact, the partner who had been putting up the money just said, well, after some negotiations, first he wanted to sell his share to us. And we weren't interested, we were trying to find a buyer for it. And now he's just abandoned his share, walked out. We have it all, but we certainly would not be in a position to put up the money, even if we felt sure of all the future of Peru. We'd have to find somebody who'd be willing to put up the additional money for further exploration. And there would be a matter of negotiation for how much they would get for that in ownership. That would be a very legitimate way to go at it. It's an interesting prospect, but nothing that a person who can't lose several $1 million should ever go into.
is it partly a question of timing? Are there times when it's...
Well, the timing is political just at present. The climate is so bad in Peru, where the government, which is a very nationalistic government, has insisted that some of the big companies that have fully developed and large reserves of this type of ore, but definitely established, where millions have been spent to prove they have several hundred million tons of such and such ore, now we're told that after a certain date, if they didn't put up definite plans for operating those companies, putting in a mine there and operating it, they'd lose their titles. Well, that means $200 to $300 million. That next stage is that sort of a stage. Well, it's very hard to get $200 or $300 million from anybody to spend in Peru, where you have a government that might take away titles arbitrarily. So now I really think the Peruvian government is after virtually confiscating several of those properties because the original owners could not or would not come up with that type of money. Well, what is the Peruvian government going to do? Where will they get the money? The Russians might be willing to put it up, but Russia never puts up anything without strings attached. And they'd find themselves in a much worse position than we are. Now, the Japanese have put up some money, for they're avid for that type of thing, but they're not going to put up those $200 or $300 million. We have another little mine down in southern Peru, where it's a few millions have been spent in developing it to making sure that there is a little mine. The next step goes into some tens of millions. It's a relatively small thing, and the Japanese are participating in that in order to get the concentrates from it, and we run it. But all those things are balances, where you balance first the geology, the engineering, and then the politics. And then next door you have the awful example of Chile, which has gone completely Marxist or communist, and are actually taking over these tremendous companies, and of course paying for them with Chilean bonds, which the company will have to accept on their face value, and they will be worth a few percent of what the face value is.
Well, you're really referring to the election of Allende?
Yes. Well, in the meantime, the great Anaconda Company has practically lost its Peruvian, its Chilean properties, in which they've spent, I suppose, at least over $1 billion must have gone into that. And of course they had fat big returns from it, but still they had the titles, and the Chilean government was getting the by far overwhelming percentage of the profits through taxes, but no, they want to take it over and run it.
It's a sort of ex post facto act, in the sense that what was done earlier was done legally earlier.
Oh, it was all legal.
No longer legal.
All completely legal. They simply, any sovereign government has the right to expropriate private property if they pay for it. Mm-hmm. Well, they take it over and they pay for it and say that these bonds are as good as they, but they're not. Mm-hmm. There are legal ways to commit fraud. That's what it really amounts to, in our sense. But the way that's been practiced in a great many places. I always think of a drawing. I think it was, I don't know whether it was in the New York or the Saturday Review, of two Arabs sitting up on a hill looking down at a refinery that was being built. One said, "Shall we go in and take it over?" And the other said, "No, wait till they finish it." Well, these are the days it's very hard to have anybody put up money to finish one of those things, or even start it anymore.
But do you think that this really means that the major explorations based in this country are really not going to be permitted in other countries anymore?
Well, I don't think, yes, well, I don't think we would, they'd love to have us come down and spend more money. We, I'm sure, would have all the assurances in the world if we wanted to go down and spend the money to develop one of those coppers. Mm-hmm. We spend the money, everything would be sweet and lovely, but why do you do it? In the light of what they're all, what the attitude they're taking.
Right.
So the money's dried up. And it's a big power struggle. Those countries don't have the capital to do that sort of thing. The rich people in those countries, I'm sure, have a good deal of their money is now in Paris.
Yes, one wonders about the Swiss bank accounts and all the other methods.
If they were wise, they'd get their money out of the country. But people who have great landed estates which they can't take out, are suffering very great losses. Those are being taken over and of course paid for in this pious way, but really not effectively paid for. Oh, it's a form of revolution.
Yes, yes, I can see this redistribution of wealth when you have enormously poor, big populations.
Yeah. So, they take over a great sugar estate, and it doesn't mean that can be broken up, and you can put the thousands or hundreds of thousands of peasants of poor people on that, because you can't operate a great sugar enterprise in small particles, so it'll have to be operated as a government controlled thing and as a government corporation. So you just shift the emphasis and you'll have a group of bureaucrats running that government, running that enterprise, and probably being far more ruthless than the original owners in relation to the labor that works on it.
So it must be incorporated.
You can't run them as small things. The great agricultural exports, one of the great agricultural exports of Peru is sugar. And sugar doesn't lend itself to farming. It's a great enterprise with a huge acres and acres and acres of sugarcane and a big mill, or it's nothing. Mm-hmm. And cotton is very much the same thing. You'd simply have poverty if you had a few acres of people growing cotton and picking it and sending in a few bales. But if you can make it in many thousands of acres and do it in a great routine way and bring things into a great central factory, why, it is profitable. So I'm very sure any nationalistic government that takes over those enterprises, takes over such properties, will simply have to run them the way you run them, any big industry that they would take over. Except in that case, it would be government run. Just as in this country now, the railroads are in such a bad state, the government might take over the railroads, but the railroads would still be run by a small group of people, but they would be government officials, probably even less competent than the ones who are doing it now. But the people don't do it. This business saying the people, they can't do anything.
Well, you're suggesting that willingness to venture investments into certain areas is changing. Does that suggest that people are looking for more safe areas to invest in?
Yes. Well, in exploration today, and most mining companies and oil companies are interested in exploration. The world is very restricted as to where you can put your money. Well, it's almost the English-speaking world. It's Canada, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand. Mexico is enjoying a stable government and a fairly good boom, and exploration is going on in Mexico. Though there you have to, the taxes are prohibitive unless the enterprise is 51% controlled by Mexicans. But there is lots of money in Mexico. Mexicans have now, a country has been created that has capitals, so they can put in their capital too.
Do you foresee this happening in any of the South American countries?
Brazil and Argentina both have that degree of power. Most of the others have financial power. Mm-hmm. I doubt if many others would. Venezuela, if the government was stable enough and the revenues from oil were used that way, could also, I suppose. But they haven't. I'm not very familiar with the developments there.
Are you familiar with the argument that it may be time for us to stop consuming the fossil fuel deposits and save them for synthesizing into something else?
You would say it was time to stop utilizing power, but turn off the power on one of our cities and what happens? There's the other form of power would be nuclear power.
Yes.
And I think that there's most intense effort being made to develop nuclear power to a stage where it will be take a larger and larger, supply a larger and larger percentage of the country's power. But there are obstacles to nuclear power. Also, the environmentalists can block that, I think very stupidly and unwisely. But the nuclear power seems to go in surges. There was a time that too much was expected, and then everybody was disappointed. Then there was another great surge. Nuclear power within a certain stage would be the dominant power. Now that's fading, and difficulties are encountered. And I think we'll have some more really technical breakthroughs, and then it will be going up to another surge. But there's an enormous amount of really technical engineering development has to be accomplished before these nuclear power developments really become highly competitive. They are at the stage now where very great, very large nuclear power plants are competitive with coal or oil, depending on your locality. But modest-sized ones are not.
That's interesting.
And then, of course, if you would have one, say, way up in the northern Arctic where you couldn't get oil or coal or something, well, yes, it would be competitive. But if you're sitting here in California with seaborne oil, it wouldn't be competitive. But the big power companies are turning to nuclear power because they can see that that's likely to be the great development of the future. They want to be in a position where they've mastered the art and the technique. But it's quite a standoff at present. Five or six years ago, there were more nuclear power plants being built than fossil fuel plants. And now I think it's gone back. There's a little less enthusiasm for the nuclear power, more recognition that the fossil fuels are still important. But these things can't be handled in emotional ways, which I think is becoming so evident in this worry about ecology and pollution, things of that sort. The first people to yell would be our conservationists if a city had a blackout. Why didn't you build these power plants to prevent this? there's been such a gradual increase. Well, the gradual increase in population, great steady increase in the needs for power, that our whole life of a country is dependent now on power. And the major source of power are fossil fuels. And from a practical standpoint, you just can't imagine somebody saying, well, we're not going to mine a certain rate of these fuels. Who's going to take care of the necessary expansion? And we keep using more and more and more power all the time. not by necessarily planning it that way, but it just works that way.
Well, you were saying a little earlier that I guess it was Homestake that had gotten into the uranium development.
Yes.
Field. Is this still important?
Oh, yes, it is. We got into, when we went into uranium, it was at that time the great use of uranium was for weapons, and the Atomic Energy Commission, in order to ensure a adequate supplies of uranium, made contracts where they would guarantee it was first up to the year 66, and these were done in the 50s, where you would build a mill, you put up your own money to build a mill, find the mines.
When you say build a mill, is that to crush the ore?
Yes. The ore, many millions have to go into these mills. The ore is a black oxide, or bright yellows and reds, and bright yellows oxidized material in sedimentary rocks. And the first of the ores were rather shallow seated ones and were many little pockets. And then some quite extensive deeper ores were found, 3 or 4, even 1,000 feet below, down in wet ground. And those were very big reserves. One of those was at near Grants, New Mexico, in a place called Ambrosia Lake. I think the name came from a sheep herder named Ambrosio. It was his place where he watered sheep, so they called it Ambrosio's Lake, but it became known as Ambrosia Lake. Well, that was an accidental discovery. It wasn't too accidental. It was a bright piece of exploration by a geologist to put a Geiger counter on the sludges from an old oil well that had been drilled on a small dome. They didn't find any oil, but he, as a matter of curiosity, wanted to see if they had hit any radioactive material. There were uranium deposits some 20 miles away on the outcrops, way back in this valley. He happened to find radioactive material in the sludge of this old well. So they put down a couple of holes, 300 or 400 feet, and ran into what turned out to be one of the most, the biggest and most valuable uranium reserves on the continent.
Now, when you have, is it a license to prospect for oil, and you find something else, is that transferable?
The oil license is separate, but there was we have a genius for complex and unworkable laws in this country. See, there was a lot of oil leases over ground in which uranium was found. And under the old law, the existence of those leases prohibited anybody from staking claims. But here, in the Moab region, that's MOAB, in Utah, there was a rather wild, broken-down geologist named Steen. Stuck a hole down and hit some extraordinarily rich ore. And all that country then became staked. That is, you stake a mining claim.
You describe the area that you...
Yes, well, you have to follow the law, 1,500 feet long, 600 feet wide and so on. It's rather a ridiculous law. Well, this country then became plastered with these claims over on top of oil leases, which had no real validity. And yet, the Atomic Energy Commission assumed complete control of all uranium. So they recognized the validity of those claims. But there were many very big transactions, big deals made, in which these illegal claims were sold and transferred, and it took a new law to straighten it out, to allow such claims to be filed. That is the law now, so those claims all stand. But there was a period in which those claims could have been declared illegal. That's by a strict interpretation of the law.
Fantastic.
Oh, that was one of the uranium developments for one of the wild mineral rushes, like the old-fashioned gold rushes back in the early 50s. Well, but then to go on with uranium, the my feeling, we got some very good ground, developed a couple of mines in that same country at, near Moab, where the Steen discovery was. They weren't as good as his, but they were good mines. And they're practically very nearly worked out now. And then we got in another group of, into another big enterprise in Grants in New Mexico, where in a partnership with people who had then had some ground of which there were big reserves, and we formed a partnership at the beginning in which we had a 25% interest. They retained the 75%, but we managed it, and we financed the mill. That went into a good many millions. That is, you mine this stuff, and then you have to put it through really an elaborate metallurgical process to get the uranium oxide out in a concentrated form. And all that was done with the assurance that the Atomic Energy Commission would buy so many million pounds of uranium oxide at $8 a pound. And that would mean that ore containing 1% uranium, that would be 20 pounds, would be worth $160, you see, in the ground. So the ore down there in the beginning was running about 0.2%, so that was would be running about, let's see, my arithmetic's right, be about $16 per ton of ore. And that, you'd have to mine it, and that meant you'd have to put down your shafts, develop a mine, extract it, take it out, put it through the mill, and pay for the mill and extract the uranium in the milling process. And you sell a bright yellow powder uranium oxide, which the AEC took at $8 a pound. And that ran until 1966. And then there was some nominal extensions, which didn't mean very much. And the final contracts have just expired now. But in those days, you had to sell to the AEC. There was no private market. They didn't allow anybody else to buy. Then in the last, after 66, the market was made, was opened so that the big customers have been the big power companies. And when we went into it, my feeling was we should go into it on the expectation that we would get our money back from the cost of developing the mines and the mills and make an adequate profit and by the end of the contract, and anything else was velvet. Well, we're still running.
Is it
but we don't get $8 a pound for it anymore. The market's considerably below that.
Is it fair to ask what you consider a reasonable profit in percent?
Well,
it hard to tell?
In a mining property, you see, you have to get your money back within the life of the mine. Mm-hmm. So what you're actually making the annual profit is returning your capital as well as your profit. And I think in anything as speculative as uranium mining, I used to tell the boys, get your money back and double it in 5 years. That would be a 20% thing, but I don't think we very seldom accomplish that. And people will buy stocks of gold mines today where the actual earnings as of today are very, very small, so that their profit might be 0.5% or something like that, in anticipation that there's going to be a rise in the price of gold and they will get there. They will make a reward. As a company has nothing to do with that. We have nothing whatever to do with what the price of homestake is selling for on the market.
Do the uranium mines have depletion allowances for
yes.
tax?
Mm-hmm. Yes. they have that of course gives a gives you quite a little tax benefit, and that helps.
Well, this brings us rather neatly to your list of activities with the United States government, and I wonder if you would like to perhaps comment on some of them. I have a list. I'm not at all sure that it's complete. I was thinking really of your chairmanship of the Advisory Committee on Raw Materials for the AEC,
yes.
1947 to 52.
Well, I think that was my most interesting assignment. I had a very good friend on the who was one of the commissioners who knew me, Sumner Pike, and he was, I think, in the early days of the Atomic Energy Commission, he felt there should be advisory committees set up of people who were knowledgeable in the different particular activities. There were advisory committees of the physicists and so on. So he was had a good deal to do with mining and oil, and he wanted an advisory committee made up of people who knew about ore deposits. And then John Gustafson was then the first manager of raw materials. He subsequently became president of Homestake, you know,
yes,
and now chairman of the board. And I think he and Sumner Pike set up this advisory committee. I wish I could remember all the names of the people on that, but they...
Perhaps just those who stand out.
Thorold Field, Thorold, T-H-O-R-O-L-D, Field. He was a grandson of the great Cyrus Field.
Was
he? He was a very interesting person in mining, an engineer and geologist, and Everett de Gaulle was on that committee. Thank God, Mama, you seem to have a cold.
I do this when the weather is cold.
Yeah, I'll
carry your book. Mr. McLaughlin has gone to get a book, and we'll be back in a moment.
I won't show you a particular book about de Gaulle. It's just that it was wrapped up to be mailed.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, there was just a comment in it that Sumner Pike had asked him and Wallace Pratt, another oil man.
Wallace Pratt?
Pratt and myself to serve on that committee. I don't think Wallace Pratt did, but de Gaulle did for a while. And that committee was purely an advisory committee. We had fairly frequent meetings, and the requirements for uranium were told to us. Now, where are you going to get it?
I see. And so your function was to advise on exploration?
Yes, it was exploration, largely. And metallurgy, too. I remember one of the first problems that was put up to that committee was, should some of these big uranium mills that had, they were big for those days, in Colorado, be reactivated? They were practically shut down. Because after the war, of course, there was peace. There was no further need for weapons. But then it was realized that we'd better give a little attention to our weapon situation and be in a position to make atomic bombs if necessary. And up until that time, the main source of uranium had been the Shinkolobe mine in the Congo, Belgian Congo.
I'm going to have to ask you to spell it.
Oh my gosh, S-H-I-N-K-O. L-O-B-W-E, I think.
Oh.
That was a mine, a very rich uranium mine, owned by the great Katanga Company, the money on money to Katanga. And in a quite dramatic way, the manager of that company named Sanjay, gosh, how do you spell it? S-A-N-G-E-R, something like Sanjay, S-A-N-G-E, or S-I-N-G-E. When the Germans took over, invaded Belgium, he got out of Belgium with all the records of the company, the Katanga Company, came to the United States. And he had some hunch that uranium was important, and shipped a lot of the uranium out of the Congo, fear they would lose it, into the United States. I don't know how he got a hunch. And when, in the early days of the atomic bomb effort, they were looking for, trying to get uranium, they went to Sanjay about this, and he said, yes, it's right here. There was a lot of uranium brought over.
Oh, how do you store uranium when you bring it over?
Well, it's the uranium before it's processed is perfectly harmless.
I see.
Oh, it would have. It would be. I think he was shipped over. It'd be the uranium oxide, about yellow oxides.
What a curious story.
Yes. Anyway, he was able to deliver the great bulk of the uranium needed for the bombs. We had uranium in the Colorado Plateau, but it was a small amount. And there was uranium from the Great Bear Lake deposits in Canada, also small, but none of it adequate for what was foreseen to be the demands. So at that time, all uranium sources were studied very carefully, and an exploration program was started, especially in Colorado, and which gradually spread out into Utah and New Mexico. And with the Geological Survey made studies, and the Bureau of Mines also. But the critical thing was the establishment of what they called a field price, whereby buying stations were put up in these centers, and any miner coming in with his uranium ore could sell it for a fixed price, $8, and then they had allowances for transportation, for freight, from these little deposits. There were lots of little mines there, and which made it a very profitable thing. And once it was realized by these prospectors and little miners that they could make good money out of it, that was what led to the intense prospecting. While a lot of stuff that sounded awfully wild, in fact, I remember one quite famous mining engineer who was on the committee, his name it was Fred Searles, said that he thought it was just wasting money to do all this drilling to find so many little deposits.
But then
Steen hit a big one. And that then things took fire, and then the great, there was ore, uranium found way down in New Mexico by an old drunken Indian named Patty Martinez. On Anaconda land, on Santa Fe land, and the Santa Fe people turned to the Anaconda Company, and Anaconda built a mill with a contract with the atomic energy. And that started uranium production down there, and then this discovery I told you about back in the interior of the deeper ores was found, and then the Kerr McGee Company went in.
What was that?
Kerr McGee, a big oil company.
Kerr McGee. Mm-hmm.
And Phillips Petroleum went in. We were in it.
Can you say we did?
That was Homestake. It was called the Homestake Safin Partnership.
Oh yes, I think you mentioned that earlier.
And but the critical thing, getting back to the advisory committee and Gustafson, was that they established the Gustafson established an advisory committee highly approved of the of creating a price which made it possible, really, in accordance with good free enterprise and the old-fashioned Western spirit, for intense prospecting to go on, and then for small people and bigger people and bigger people taking chances. The ore was such that a person who had just a nominal amount of money could put down 20 or 30 foot drill holes and possibly hit some uranium. Then they found it, the next thing, there were 200 or 300 foot holes being driven. And now they're actually putting down holes to 4,000 or 5,000 feet.
Which may
or may not be wise or economical, but it's being done in searching for uranium. Well, when those holes would be $50,000 or $60,000 apiece, but they're not done by small people.
Right.
So that's the way that story has grown.
I'm just watching because we're coming to the end of one side. I might raise a question in this connection. Was there any problem of conflict of interest in people on the advisory commission?
Yes, it was a very, and I did a very bad thing for my company being on that committee at all, because it kept us out of uranium.
I see.
And
that's a hard thing.
I really shouldn't have done it. And because after I got off the committee, I had to wait a couple of years before.
Oh, does the law require that?
No, the law doesn't require, but that was seemed a proper legal.
Well, you probably have a greater feeling of nicety, perhaps, than some other people.
But at that time, unfortunately, the things that we were in hadn't been we're in now hadn't been discovered then.
I see.
But I was beginning to realize that we were all in it sort of as a patriotic thing.
Quite.
And it didn't look for quite a while as if it was going to be a great big commercial venture. The Anaconda people were one of the first big ones to get into it. Of course, the United States Vanadium and the Union Carbide Company had mills in operation.
Now I think I'm going to
But those mills had been developed primarily for vanadium.
I'm going to have to ask you what vanadium is. Is it a metal?
It's a metal, an alloy, a metal that's used as an alloy metal in special steels.
Oh, is it a hardening?
It's a hardening and toughening metal.
Let's see. Well, I think I'll let it run out. It sometimes blurs at the end of the tape,
I see,
and I don't want you to say anything important going on the last little bit. What a fascinating field this all is.
We did touch upon this a little bit before.
Just a little, yes. You were talking really about trying to ease the financial problems of the gold mine by extending it into another area, but we hadn't gotten into any of this.
Uranium itself.
You mentioned Steen, I think.
Yes.
And this rather odd situation that developed with him.
He was and is a very odd character.
He's still with us.